You're listening to Mischief Media.
Action chapters.
Action chapters.
These are action chapters.
Welcome to Extraneous.
Hi, everybody. I'm Will.
I'm Melissa.
And we are action chapters.
This is our new team name?
Well, just these are action-packed chapters.
Okay, welcome to the action-packed chapter portion of Extraneous, where Melissa can't remember the tagline
what are we
suddenly.
Doing, Melissa? What happens here?
Dig deep into stories you love and come back with a little submission.
Yeah,
Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay, great. This week we are doing actually three. I know we usually do two. We're doing three chapters of Amber Spyglass because they felt like they were of a piece.
Yeah, they're like an episode.
As a reminder, you are listening to a Mischief Media podcast, and you should look up Mischief Media to find out everything that means. You can do that in your little podcast player, your little thing. And let's go ahead and get into it.
Absolutely, let's do it. Summary, who's up?
It's me.
It's you.
Ooh, okay. You got your phone?
Hold on.
You got your phone? Your timer? Sleeping on the timer?
I was distracted by all the action.
A lot of action packed action.
Jean-Claude Van Damme is Swiss Guard.
Tell me when.
Go.
In this chapter, all the forces are converging on the cave where Mrs. Coulter has Lyra. Amma's coming to rescue her. Will's coming to rescue her. The Gallivespians are coming to take her to Lord Asriel, and the Consistorial Court of Discipline and the Holy Society of other thing is going to come and kill her. So we want at least one of those factions to fail. Will and Yorick make their way up. They meet up with Amma. Amma tells them how they're going to get the girl in the cave to be awake and alive, and she's very insistent that she goes in too because she's a brave little girl, and we'll talk about that. And then Will and Mrs. Coulter meet and have a very interesting conversazione. Uh-huh. And then while all these forces are coming together, Will tries to rescue Lyra, but Mrs. Coulter has seen this trick before where Will cuts into the world, so she has moved Lyra when he comes back to go get her, and he is almost successful, gets Lyra, pulls her away, and then goes to close the window, and whoops, looked at Mrs. Coulter wrong, and the knife breaks. It's a big moment. And then the Gallivespians attack Mrs. Coulter, which stops her from interfering in Will taking Lyra away. And the Gallivespians say, "We have to take you to Lord Asriel. We demand you follow us to Lord Asriel." And Will and Lyra are like, "Yeah, lol." And they run through the window that Will cut open previously to get away from all the drama. And no drama. And then they talk to the Gallivespians about what they're going to do next. Did I get everything?
Yeah, pretty much.
Pretty much.
There's a little chat at the end of the third chapter that we're doing. 13, I guess, between Lyra and Will. But other than that, you nailed it.
Oh, yeah. I'll add 3 seconds to my total because Lyra wakes up and is like, "Oh, I dreamt we have to go to the world of the dead." Spoiler alert, Will. We have a new mission.
Yeah, and Will's like, "Oh, finally, we made it. We did it. All the things we needed
did
to
it.
Do.
I've rescued you, and now we're going to go to Laura's Adam's."
We can just go to Laura's.
She's like,
"Oh,
little pit stop.
Yeah.
Just kind of stop at the off ramp. Can we stop at the rest stop? In the world of the dead." What was that? "The world, we're going to go to the world of the dead." Okay. Will's just like, "Sure, let's go."
Let's go.
What a guy.
I mean, he's nothing if not down, for the next adventure.
Down to clown.
All right. Well, that was good. You came in, by the way, at
147-ish. Okay.
Yeah, with the extra 3 seconds. Not bad.
I'll take it.
For those of you keeping track at home.
Is there anyone keeping track at home?
Are there stats? Are there standings?
crit roll stats, but for our one stat.
Mm-hmm.
How fast?
Extraneousstats.com.
Very short website
today. I know. It's just one page.
It's just an Excel sheet. Okay. So let's go ahead and get into our epigraphs.
Our epigraphs, yeah. We have, first of all, a familiar epigrapher here, William Blake.
It's his fave.
Philip Pullman's fave.
Yeah, one of his faves.
I think so.
Epigraphs him a lot.
I agree.
A truth that's told with bad intent beats all the lies you can invent, which sounds like a nursery. Like, mm-hmm. It sounds like something people whisper to each other. Actually, when I was Googling around and seeing what people have had to say about this quote, a lot of people don't credit William Blake with it. Mm. They just say it. Mm-hmm. Like, because it does sound like something just any old human could come up with.
Right. And I think that's what he tried to do with mm-hmm. a lot of his poems. He was telling, like, allegories. So he intentionally made them, like, yeah. Like Aesop's fables, kind of.
Well, this is the epigraph to chapter 11, which is the one where Mrs. Coulter tells her story to Will, uncharacteristically truthful. So I think it's one of his very obvious ones that's like, yeah, she's telling the truth, but you always got to look at her motive.
Yes. Yeah. And I love this. I think it's so such a sophisticated way to understand Mrs. Coulter as someone who, and we've seen Lyra do this too, where they understand that the truth does have a lot of value and that you can absolutely weaponize it and, you know, tell the truth and get all the advantages of telling the truth and, like, put a lot of sincere emotion into what you're saying. But then, like, at the end, kind of twist it. You know, it's like you change the circuit on the track and the train just at the last second goes to a different track. So you have all the convincingness of being sincere and honest, but your ultimate end is insincere. There's a great Tyrion line, and I don't remember exactly what it is.
I was trying to look it up, but I couldn't find it. There's so many great Tyrion lines that it's when you look up a Tyrion quote, you're just
awash. It's like, here's a million. But yeah, Cersei is famous in Game of Thrones for being very good at this. You know, she uses her sincere feelings for her children or whatever to very twisted, power-hungry ends.
He says it's her one trait, is her unquestioned love for her children. So what can we identify as Mrs. Coulter's bad intent here? Does she have bad intent, or has she really changed in her alignment?
This is the question of the day.
Of the book?
Yeah.
Of the series?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I feel like Mrs. Coulter is, her emotions with Lyra are so complicated that she does, I think, want to keep her safe. But I feel like there's more to it. I feel like she also resents Lyra. She resents Lyra's freedom. She resents Lyra's, like, the fact that Lyra has her whole life in front of her and can kind of be whatever she wants.
Well, we'll talk more about Mrs. Coulter when we get to her in the chapter. But again, a truth that's told with bad intent beats all lies you can invent, I think, is pretty clearly pointing there.
Mm-hmm.
And then there we have the second one. Will's going to take the lead on this one because he knew who this guy was and I did not. It's as still as he fled. This is the epigraph to chapter 12. Still as he fled, his eye was backward cast as if his fear still followed him behind. And it's a quote by Edmund Spenser.
Yeah. So this is from The Faery Queen. The Faery Queen is Edmund Spenser's gigantic early Elizabethan, like, epic poem. That's like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages long.
In particular, from a book, this particular poem inside The Faery Queen, it's called The Cave of Despair.
So The Faery Queen is, it's a lot of things, but it's like it's basically a big allegory to the greatness of Queen Elizabeth and her kingdom. Spenser actually worked for the crown. He was like a civil servant his whole life. He is known these days for The Faery Queen, which mm-hmm. is primarily known as a book that people are forced to read small amounts of in college.
I saw a great Huffington Post article that said this is the most unremarkable thing that has ever basically existed. Let me find the actual words because it was funny. Few writers have a reputation as uninspiring as Edmund Spenser, a poet who commands hardly any general readers and who English undergraduates routinely shun. This is a Huffington Post article from 2012.
Yeah. So, I mean, Edmund Spenser, he's important historically. A lot of people see him as the bridge between like Chaucer and more modern English verse.
Okay.
Because if you actually read him, the way like his spellings are wild, it's very Chaucerian. You can actually read it, whereas Chaucer, often you have to actually know Middle English to get through it. So it's like historically important, mm-hmm. but it's not the most compelling read. And it's so long.
Indulgent.
Yeah.
It is the Gravity's Rainbow of its time.
In a sense, it's heavily allusional. Yeah. It's like as a portrait of the literary mind of Elizabethan England, it is a fascinating historical document. But if that does not get you going, then you're not going to like this. But Edmund Spenser is also very well known for an essay he wrote just about the same time as he wrote The Faerie Queen in 1596, called A View on the Present Situation in Ireland, I believe is the full title. And it's a horrific document. I mean, even in the 16th century, it was considered an extreme document. It's a document that calls for the genocide of the Irish people. It points to previous warfare that has used widespread routine famine and genocide in Ireland and talks about how well that's gone. He's like, there's passages about like how the Irish poured out of their homes and took to cannibalism and their children died and, you know, their, you know, bodies littered the streets. And he's like, isn't this great? Like, this is the only way to control the Irish. Because they are genetically, I mean, he didn't use genetically, but they're like descended from different creatures than the English and most humans. And so they're subhuman. And so they're incapable of understanding natural law. And so the only way to get rid of them basically is to starve them to death and then resettle Ireland with the English.
Is it possible that Philip Pullman didn't know he was drawing on the words? Like, I feel like this is the kind of thing that today, no matter how celebrated or wonderful an author was, if you draw on the words of someone with genocidal beliefs, somebody's going to say like, hey, what the F? What are you doing? Somebody in the publishing house would be like, you can't, no, we don't use those words. But Philip Pullman, I guess, you know, 20 years ago, it was a different thing.
Yeah, I think, I mean, he was just Spenser was just part of the standard English curriculum along with, you know, he would be taught next to Blake and taught next to everybody else.
Like, problematic is one thing. Genocidal is another.
It's an openly genocidal document. And he was a civil servant. He was living in Ireland. He was living on an estate that had been like, you know, like all the English estates cleared of Irish tenants. And so he was very much right in the center of all of this colonialism and was an open advocate. And it was this document in its own day. I've read up a bit and there's some debate about how widespread it was. But even in those days, it was considered a really extreme document. And when it was published, it was often published with certain elements of it, like edited out. Because it was just too violent and too extreme in its like anti-Irish racism.
You got canceled?
Yeah, I mean, I'm joking. Yeah.
It's what they would call canceling when it really is the rightful.
Matt Gaetz would be like, I can't believe they cut all this passage. I'm being canceled.
How dare
we
not be able to advocate for, oh my goodness.
But yeah, it was pretty extreme. I mean, it would fit right in with like National Socialist, like race science and stuff like that.
Yeah. So going back to this incredibly horrible person, what do we think this quote kind of refers to? Still as he fled, his eye was backward cast, as if his fear still followed him behind. So this is chapter 12. This is this Will's attraction to Mrs. Coulter?
I don't know. It's kind of a mystery. I don't know the context of this quote. Yeah, I don't know.
So that's that epigraph. And then our third one.
It is another William Blake quote. Frowning, frowning night, o'er this desert bright, let thy moon arise while I close my eyes. Maybe just referring to the place where they escape at the end.
Oh, right, that moonlit.
Yeah. Again, this may be just a straight literal.
He really is very literal about these.
Yeah.
okay, great. Let's go ahead and talk about the characters and the way they change in these three chapters.
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, Will. Let's start right in with Will.
Will, what do you think?
He's getting a lot more resolute, dangerous, intimidating, powerful, and devoted to Lyra. All those things of a piece. And I'm particularly thinking about in chapter 13 when the Galvespians try and shame them and Will just says, no, I'm not to be spoken to like that. Respect goes both ways. And like they also, when they have that stalemate between the Galvespians and Will, and I have this in further notes to talk about it, but you know, when two people are pointing a gun at each other, it's an ostensible stalemate. But in this situation, everybody knew that Will was the one who would shoot and the other ones would not. And so, like, you start to understand what Serafina Pecola was talking about when she said, I looked in his eyes and I was, like, I was afraid of what I saw there, what's happening in this chapter.
Yeah, I agree.
But let's talk for a minute about his relationship to Mrs. Coulter. And I guess we'll talk about Mrs. Coulter in all of this as well.
Yeah. I mean, puberty is a big piece of it.
Yes.
Like, Mrs. Coulter is essentially seducing him, and it's a little uncomfortable. and it never crosses the line into anything inappropriate.
Right.
But she is definitely aware of her effect on him. And he is not looking for this. This is like a fifth column almost. It's like an internal ambush that he was not expecting.
The part where she says, no, she knows nothing of Will. She doesn't know his history. She doesn't know that his mother is ill. At least there's no way that we would think that she did.
Yeah.
But the fact that she invoked his mother and what Will says afterwards, that either she didn't know the boil that she had lanced or she was monstrously clever. We know that she's monstrously clever and that she did that on purpose. And it is just her knowledge of boys and men and their attachments to their mothers. And if you want to make them a little bit vulnerable, mention his mother and see what happens. And I think she really did just sort of send that test balloon out to see and then saw it happen in his face and didn't know, maybe wasn't 100% that she would hit it, but knew that was the button to try.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Yeah, totally. And Lyra, we've seen Lyra do this too. And we know that Lyra is just kind of like Mrs. Coulter 2.0 in this sense. In this way.
Next generation, at least.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In her ability to manipulate people.
Yes.
And yet, we've seen Lyra also, she probes her weak spots. And when she finds one, she's very quick about assembling a plan to assault that weakness. And yeah. I think Mrs. Coulter is doing the same thing here. I think she has the same abilities.
Everybody that Will meets, they size him up and they recognize that they cannot manipulate her. Well, they can manipulate it, but they cannot overtake him. They recognize him as an equal. Yorick did this. The Gallivespians do this. Mrs. Coulter does this. Mrs. Coulter meets him, knows he has the knife, sizes him up, and even the monkey who's dying to kill him, you know, she shakes her head at him and basically does the calculation and says, all right, this is going to have to be through emotional manipulation. I can't overtake him, he's dangerous. I'm gonna have to try this in a more subtle way. And so, like you said, she uses her wiles, she uses her motherly charms whatever it is.
Motherly charms intermingling with, you know, seduction.
Yeah.
You know, she's aware that these things can get muddy, especially for like young men who are subject, you know.
It's a heady mix of lots of manipulative factors. She also tells him the truth. It seems, you know, does anybody really successfully lie to Will?
It's a really good question. Lyra doesn't try.
And if Lyra doesn't try to lie, you have to imagine that anyone with a good emotional intelligence, as Mrs. Coulter does, just thinks, nah, it's not going to work on this guy.
Yeah.
And that's another quality of Will's.
Well, I was going to say Charles Leitrim does. He lies.
Oh, right. The alethiometer nonsense. Yeah.
So it's possible.
I guess it is possible. Yeah. He lies to Lyra.
Oh, he lies to Lyra. Oh, yeah.
Which leads Will to his house. I don't think he directly lies to Will. Once they're there, he tells him the pretty much spitting truth of like, I have you. What are you going to do? Call the police?
Wow. That's a great point. Yeah. He gets the alethiometer from Lyra. Of course he does. How would Will have it before then?
Right.
Wild. I don't know. Hey, right. Let us know if you can think of
somebody who lies successfully to Will.
Yeah. At any point in these three books. But we can't come up with one off the top of our heads.
So Will, confused in his emotions, mixing Mrs. Coulter and his mother, seeing, you know, he's talked before about how badly he wants mothering and somebody to tell him it's okay, and seeing a very domesticated Mrs. Coulter also mingled with his feelings for Lyra. There has to be a lot of it in there. He goes to escape with Lyra and tries to cut a window, breaks the knife because of a look at Mrs. Coulter. And here's the quote.
But he looked up. He looked at Mrs. Coulter. She had turned around silently, and the glare from the sky reflected off the damp cave wall hit her face. And for a moment it wasn't her face at all. It was his own mother's face, reproaching him, and his heart quailed from sorrow. And then as he thrust with the knife, his mind left the point, and with a wrench and a crack, the knife fell in pieces to the ground. It was broken. Now he couldn't cut his way out at all.
I guess, think about this for a second. Mm-hmm. How did that break the knife? Obviously, besides they needed to break the knife so that they didn't, for plot reasons.
Right, besides the plot.
Yeah.
here's the theory. The knife becomes a part of him when he's cutting. He has to like put his soul to the tip of the knife is how it was described to him. And I think at that moment, his soul or his selfhood or whatever became very divided and became not like broken isn't the word because it was just a momentary thing. But I think his selfhood was in two different places at that moment. And now that I think about it, I kind of like this theory because Will is always so present, right? He's practical. He's present. He looks people right in the face. He doesn't avert his eyes. They all talk about like his face, his fierce gaze that like holds people. And this is a moment where he was looking at Mrs. Coulter and he saw his mother and he like disassociated himself. But if his self is in the knife, maybe by being in two places at once, it, you know, yeah. undid the
because he's trying
spiritual...
to like push his will out. Yeah. And his will needs to be fully wanting to leave. He has to get to that negative capability space where like your whole will becomes in that action. And his will is going, no, I want to stay here, Mrs. Coulter. I want to stay here. And but it's interesting that it doesn't just not work. It breaks.
Yeah.
So it teaches him, first of all, a very important lesson about the knife. And also gives him an important piece of information for later.
His mind left the point and then it breaks.
But that's not the whole thing because later he has to specifically think of Lyra. So to break the knife, I think you're right. I think you need to be divided. Your will has to be not fully in the destination.
He lost intentionality for that moment.
Yeah.
And no one else could break the knife but him, right? Because anyone else,
no one else could use the knife.
Yeah, exactly. Just be waving around in the air. But him with whatever physics, metaphysics of what he's doing is, it requires full intentionality. So that's a theory. I don't know.
Yeah.
Definitely let us know your theories. It's a wild moment. It shocked me. I was so sad when this happened. When I first read it, I was like, I didn't know that was an option.
Right. Right.
It's
right.
A magic knife.
Right. It's like, spoiler, when the alethiometer does its thing at the end of the book. So yeah. I think that's a lot about Mrs. Coulter, too. The one other thing I wanted to mention about Mrs. Coulter is the way she begs for them not to leave her. And I wonder if this is an undoing moment where we weren't quite sure of it. Like, she's telling the truth, but for her own ends. And now that she sees Lyra being literally taken from her, she just breaks. Because to see her, like, on the floor sobbing like that, that doesn't... I don't know, was she just trying to get them to stay? Or was she just... all out broken. Was this a ploy is my question.
It's so hard to tell with her. It's always so hard to tell. I think it was sincere, but was it only sincere or was it, again, sincerity used for insincere purposes? I really don't know.
And like, is it an insincere purpose? She wants to stop her from harm. She wants to save her from harm. She wants to not give her over to the church. But does that make it a not very sincere purpose when her way of keeping her from harm is harmful.
Right, exactly.
Denying her free will.
Exactly, you know? Yeah. And this is, in so many ways, the essence of Mrs. Coulter as a villain, that she wants to own Lyra, that she wants to keep Lyra safe, and she will take good care of her, and as long as Lyra does what she says, she won't hurt her, and she will set her up for dazzling success, you know, because Mrs. Coulter can give her every resource. The only thing that it requires from Lyra is that she stop being in any recognizable way herself. And that it's like any other kid, Mrs. Coulter would have exactly what she wants, but she has Lyra and that resentment, I think. The like the love, but also the resentment of like, I'm better than everyone I've ever met. How is my daughter the one person that might be better in the ways that Mrs. Coulter probably sees it than me? The one person who can master me. I don't know. It's a really complicated relationship.
Yeah, it really is. And it's when I first read it, I sort of resented the book for not showing us when she had this change of heart to this break from the church. It's not very clear in the book when the break from the church happens. Mm-hmm. You just sort of like, oh, wait, she's hiding in a cave with her. Okay, guess she's not handing her over to the church. Because when she gets taken by Mrs. Coulter, you think, well, that's it. Just going back to the church. And it's not this like big dramatic moment. But... yeah. As the relationship unfolds, and especially through her actions later in the book, this complicated, it's a very complicated relationship.
Yeah. And maybe I'm getting into dangerous territory here, but I think we've talked about this. Relationships between women can be very complicated. And relationships between mother and daughter can be incredibly complicated.
Yes.
And they're not always the mother loves the daughter unconditionally and just wants the best for her. Sometimes there are other feelings.
Well, that's a complicated statement to begin with. To love somebody unconditionally and want the best for them is something you can apply to what Mrs. Coulter is doing here.
Yeah. Yeah.
But her actions that she believes are the best are actually significantly harmful. And that is so true in so many real world relationships. I know what's best. I want the best for you. I don't care that you think it's actually what's harming your life and stopping your life. Mm-hmm. I know what's best. You know, mm-hmm,
totally.
And it's an arrogance, but that's a whole other conversation. All right, so that's Mrs. Coulter. Not much on the monkey. He's still a jerk. Like, the difference between
still
the
bastard still is a Melissa's bastard. Note.
It's literally in the notes. Still a bastard. I mean, the difference between the monkey in the books and the monkey in the show could not be more clear. The monkey is clearly being set up as a poor, abused creature for some reason. And in the books, it's completely flipped. He's evil. He's her evil side.
Yeah, the monkey is evil. The monkey is just a darkness walking around.
It's her deep, deep darkness. And I think later we'll have more discussions about what that means. I think there's a change coming, but he's bad. He's bad. Anyway.
Yeah. I wish the show showed that because I'm interested in that. There is an interesting story that the show is trying to tell, but like dark characters that are truly evil are interesting. And there's a lot of complicated stuff you can do with that. Also, Game of Thrones, I think, has shown us like evil sociopaths. People love them on screen. It's like it's a very watchable thing, even as it's very repulsive. So I wish they had like not chickened out and just shown the monkey as like
also
evil.
Showing Mrs. Coulter's vulnerable and redeemable side before she's had the opportunity to do so for Lyra, the way we're seeing it here, takes the sting out of when she does it for Lyra.
Yeah, right.
It's, you know, like, yes, we already knew she was redeemable. So now when she does it to save Lyra, it's, well, tell me something I didn't know.
Right.
You know?
And it becomes kind of flipped where Mrs. Coulter has some human instincts in her. Mm-hmm. But when her soul is walking around outside her body and her soul is so transparently awful, like completely devoid of any sort of maternal or caring instinct at all, just pure sadism and destruction. I mean, that must be an incredible burden for her to carry.
Yeah.
You know, even though in some sense it is also who she is. So it's not a burden. It's just a reflection. Oh, man, it's so complicated. What a good character.
Yeah, she's one of the best characters to ever exist.
Yeah.
All right. Let's talk about the Galavespians, Salamachia and Tialis.
Tialis.
I love them.
Yes.
I love them a lot. They're little proud. So you will come. We are tiny but fierce. You will come with us now. And Lyra, like Lyra actually laughs at them.
I know.
When they said like, you must come with us now. We have been ordered. And Lyra laughs out loud. I mean, she's also then quickly endangered.
Right. But and then Tialis is like, okay, I'm going to kill your demon.
Right.
How's this?
Yeah. So they hatch their dragonflies in these chapters, and their dragonflies are the size of seagulls, actually.
Yeah.
That's a really big, terrifying dragon.
I hate dragonflies.
Oh, I hate them. I know they're harmless. I hate them. Because I think they're like, they look like wasps, I guess.
I guess.
A little bit. I don't know. They just look like something that's going to sting me.
They do. Funny story. Melissa, for the first half of our relationship, did not know that dragonflies are harmless. And whenever they would fly by, I'd be like, why are you so afraid of them? She's like, they'll bite us. I'm like, no, they don't bite.
Not convinced. Gonna have to prove the negative.
You're gonna come home to a pet dragonfly.
Oh, God. You're gonna come home to an empty house. Okay.
So the whole thing with dragonflies is just so fascinating. We talked a little bit about it last episode. There's so much pathos here that like they'll wear the harnesses for their entire lives until their moment of death.
They are just bred for this, which is a conversation, sure, to be had.
It's a conversation to be had, yeah.
Enslaving these animals to their will. They treat them very well, but they mm-hmm. these animals do not have free will. They are like the grazers in Maleficent. Bred to be of service to the animals with sentience.
That's right. But they like it in some sense, though. They talk about the joy of flight, and they really, there's a joy in like serving and doing what they want to do. I mean, they're not like, it seems like the Galavespians are leaning into the dragonfly's natural tendencies.
Sure. I mean, the Galavespians have dust, right? They are sentient mm-hmm. beings. So it's different than, you know, slavery in the way we think of it of like humans and stuff like that. It's,
right.
In this world, there is, like we talked about last time, this bright dividing line of consciousness, which the Galavespians have and the animals do not. And so it doesn't seem to be a harmful thing. They also mm-hmm. only going to live for a few days, so
right.
they're being yeah. useful. They're doing yeah. their thing. But they also, like, they're really tender with them. They yeah. they care for them a lot. It's like their demon.
Yeah, it's a complicated relationship. But, I mean, you could make the argument, isn't this what Mrs. Coulter was trying to do with Lyra?
But Lyra has sentience.
Ah, yeah, that's true.
You know, so mm-hmm. the free will debate, the bestowed power from the Dustian authority this applies.
Yeah. And this is where, like we've said, you can get into some tricky territory if you start bringing in, like, ethicists who have talked about, you know, animal rights and, like, right. all animals have life and life has meaning. And
that's a perfectly valid opinion, but in these books, it's not a valid opinion. The books are very clear.
Yeah, the book does seem to set out, you know, it's, yeah, right. it's moral code. Right. Yeah.
It's like, you can believe that in life, and that is something we can debate forever. The books have made their opinion obvious.
Mm-hmm.
Other thing about that I thought was interesting about the Galavespians, in the third chapter, in chapter 13, they talk about, Lyra questions them a little bit, and they say, our world has the same problems as yours. We're outlaws. And it's a very throwaway thing, but it does sound like there is, again, a church, an authority, an oppressive religious presence that's trying to take advantage of dust for their own and of consciousness and of human works. Mm-hmm. Not human, obviously, but, you know, sentient mm-hmm. works for their own things. And they are like the little Asriels of their world. They're yeah. rebelling against it. So they heard about Asriel and they literally flew to his aid. I wonder what that is in that world, the Galavespian. Every time I hear the word Galavespian, I think Lilliputian. So the word Galavespian is sort of a combination of things. It comes from an insect, the gall wasp, or it seems to, and the word Vespa, which is Italian for wasp. So it's their whole race is based on a wasp creature.
I guess it makes sense. They're blue. They're got kind of a jewel colored, like some...
Right, they're humanoid, but they have the sting of a wasp.
Right.
I told you that dragonflies were sort of like wasps. I told you. Philip Pullman believes me. But no, the Galavespians themselves. They're like, funny. I wonder if they are wasps with human, like wasps plus dust.
Yeah, right. Like, yeah, exactly. Wasps that got dusted. Now they're like wasps with feelings and stuff.
Wasps with feelings. I don't like it. I hate it. Thanks, I hate it.
Do you like the Galavespians less now?
No, I love them, but I don't like the idea of a wasp with dust. That's all.
I agree. I'm with you. They're more human-like.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They're humanoid. They look human, but they have this stinger, this very important heel spur built into their body. All right, so Amma.
Amma is great. Amma is awesome. Amma is fine. Amma
Her
escaped.
Name means love.
Yeah.
Amma escaped. But she also, you know, Will keeps trying to say, give me the powder. I will go handle it. And Amma's just like, no, I'm coming. No, I'm coming with you. Sorry about it. I found the princess in the cave. She's not in another castle.
Yeah.
I'm going to save her. And it's wonderful. Yeah.
The wise man told me how to do it. He didn't tell you how to do it. You'll screw it up.
You'll screw it
boys.
Up. Boys. Boys, exactly. I love it. I love it.
Yeah. Her and Lyra would have been good friends.
They really, really would have been.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's fine.
Surely. She knows her way around these woods.
Yep.
You know. Lyra, like, she can move undetected.
Amma, like, does her thing, and it's like, bye.
Bye, peace.
Don't need
peace
any out, more yeah. info. Don't need to talk to you anymore. See you later. Mm-hmm. And she's also doing that, like, spider crawling
yeah.
finger over thumb thing. It's a spider move. All right, so, and then now, finally, Lyra. Lyra wakes up. We only get her in the third chapter. But she's had a revelation.
Yeah. She wakes up. She's not like, give me a second. She's like, hi, Will, you're here. That's weird. Here's 18 things I was thinking about.
Here's
you. This is you waking up.
This bugs him so much. I
it's endearing.
He's like half woken up and I'm like, okay, here's a list of 15 things we have to do today. He's like, number one is coffee, right? All right. So Lyra has been dreaming of Roger and comes to and says, yeah, we got to go for the world of the dead. But she wakes up and it's not like, I was dreaming, let me get myself together for a minute. She's just like, no, let's go. She also was very conflicted saying goodbye to Mrs. Coulter.
Mm-hmm.
That's the last time she'll see her. And she's crying. She has a face full of tears and Will makes a decision for her. And he said he had to be ruthless. He just grabs her and runs.
Yes.
And thank God for that.
Yeah. And honestly, it has nothing to do with Mrs. Coulter at that point. I mean, there is a entire army in those woods trying to find and kill them. And yeah. that is their number one purpose. And I think Will knows that. And he says, mm-hmm. we can't mess around with this.
No, gotta go. Yeah. Gotta go now.
We are in the foothills of some monumental Lyra content. up ahead. So we will talk about Lyra a lot in the next few chapters.
She immediately is reading the alethiometer a lot to get next steps and to learn if it's even possible to go to the world of the dead. Like, she's learned her lesson. Just read the read the thing. You have a truth teller. Read it.
And And you see what an incredible asset it is, because we've gone so many chapters, I think most of this book, all of this book, without having the alethiometer. So we haven't had answers. So Will has really just been wandering across Asia, essentially is what it is, from like Siberia to the Himalayas, just like by boat, by bear, by on foot, you know, dealing with threats in town after town and having no idea where to go. And so Will is really moving on faith. And I think this is maybe an underrated element of Will. It's like, we know it's going to be fine because we're at the end of this. We've read to the end of the story. Will just knows he's alone in this massive country and he hopes that he can figure out the right thing to do and that he can make it work. I mean, it is a tremendous act of faith that Will stays on this journey.
Yeah.
And now all of a sudden they have something. They're not just moving in the dark anymore. They have some cosmic voice. We've talked about what the hell it is. We don't know, but telling them, you know, this is
they've been given their quest.
Yeah. So it's really cool to have this back. I really feel like they've earned this. It's not like a deus ex machina.
Agreed. All right, that's all for our characters and dust bears, which are sort of bleeding into each other, but it's okay. Let's go on to our dust bears. So the first one we've got listed is the idea of motherhood and care, which we've talked about a lot, but I want to specifically compare Mrs. Coulter's love for Lyra to Will's mother's love for him. And when Mrs. Coulter says, like, doesn't your mother care for you? He thinks, well, actually, I've had to care for her. And it's such a cruel thought to have, And he says, obviously, that's not fair. She's unwell. So it's just bringing up a lot of questions about what is motherly care? Is what Mrs. Coulter doing more care than Mrs. Perry only giving emotional care while she couldn't really give any? I guess it's a mix of a lack of emotional and physical care. Anyway, point being, the question of what is motherhood and what is the right care that comes from that gets brought up by these conflicting thoughts.
It really calls attention, I think, to like how unfair mental health challenges can feel at times.
Yeah.
Because it's like you are being told by the world that you are failing. You have a problem that you're not allowed to have because you have certain duties in this world and you're failing them and there's like no excuse.
There's a lot of bravery themes running through, like Will walking into face Mrs. Coulter, the Calavespians, just they're pure little darts of bravery, those two. Amma's bravery, Balthamos finding and losing his bravery on and off in these chapters. He's struggling with grief. And so he knows that he's got to try and protect them from the surging hordes. And he tries and then he flies away. But just to point out, there's a lot of different types of bravery that we see.
There is. And I think it's really interesting. Balthamos has this moment of bravery, but he also has a lot of failures of like acts of cowardice where he flees and he's fleeing and like he's hiding in the cave. And Will and Lyra are so Vikings on the way to Valhalla. Like they just are so brave and so ready to jump into mortal danger, almost like it's part of their like value system. Mm-hmm. So when they talk about Balthamos, they are both blushing. They're both themselves embarrassed on his behalf because he did not have their like complete, as they put it in the Horizon Zero Dawn DLC. It's like, I've never seen someone with such complete disregard for their own life.
Yes.
It's like, they're just absolutely reckless, like recklessly, wildly brave. And it seems like an unfair standard to set for everyone, that everyone would just be completely careless of their own well-being at all times. But they do expect this of each other, and then they're hanging out with like Yorick and the Galavespians. So it is interesting. Balthamos, who to me seems like your normal level of brave and terrified, is like a real outlier amongst these like warriors, you know?
Yeah, totally. Will, he meets Mrs. Coulter, and again, Mrs. Coulter sort of marks him as an equal in her head, and he says, I can deal with you. And then there's a quote.
She sounded so kindly, and there was such sad wisdom in her eyes that Will's mistrust deepened. He felt that every word she said was a lie, every action concealed a threat, and every smile was a mask of deceit. Well, he would have to deceive her in turn. He'd have to make her think he was harmless. He had successfully deceived every teacher and every police officer and every social worker and every neighbour who had ever taken an interest in him and his home. He'd been preparing for this all his life. Right, he thought. I can deal with you.
And at the same time as Will is thinking, I can deal with you, Mrs. Coulter's thinking, oh, yeah. I can deal with you.
Right.
You know?
Right. Big time. That's totally true. And it's fascinating to see these two interact. And Will is going to return. I think she knows he's going to return. Like they both.
She moved
understand.
Lyra. She knew exactly. Yeah. I mean, he did this with the alethiometer at Charles Leitrim's house. She knew exactly what he was going to do. He was going to leave, cut a hole, take Lyra. She's like, I've seen this play before. So she moves
right,
Lyra.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's like, you know, Kobe's getting to the left block and he's still going to do it and he's still going to take the shot and there's a good chance he's going to make it. But
you got to prepare for it.
You got to prepare for it. Yeah, I really like that. It's like, you know what I'm going to do. I know what I'm going to do. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll see you there.
Another moment of a battle of wills. It's battle of wills. Many battles of wills with Will. It's that moment of stalemate that we talked about with the Gale of Espions. He says, I'm not going to be spoken that like that, so don't try. Uh-huh. Respect goes two ways. Now listen carefully. You are not in charge here. We are. And they believe him.
They believe him, yeah. I mean, he's got his hand on the hilt of the knife. They don't know it's broken, but yeah. They believe him. But it's not just the knife. It's the knife and the knife bearer. Like his demeanor, he has to sell it.
Yes.
Even if the knife was whole, it could not be. I mean, look how easily they took it from Tasso or Tullio.
Tasso. Like, who's Tasso? But I also think there's something about Will's nature, even without the knife, mm-hmm. that commanding, domineering way that he is. And he is finding more and more. The knife is almost like the coup de grace on whether you're going to listen to Will or not.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, everyone describes that Serafina doesn't know he had the knife.
Right.
And she still clocks that real quick.
The other big dust bear repeating idea, I think, is that Will and Lyra's relationship is really changing and deepening. First of all, Lyra says, hey, we have to go to the world of the dead. And Will doesn't even ask her what she means. He's just like, yeah, I guess we're going to the world of the dead.
All right.
And just the way he refers to her as my dearest friend and the way she knows when she sees him, everything is safe. Like they're just more and more of a unit. They barely even have to communicate to go to the next step together. All right, let's head out to the Dust Bunnies portion.
Dust Bunnies.
I thought it was interesting that the Gale of Espions won't touch the knife when Will leaves the knife and goes off to have a conversation with Lyra.
I don't know. It's like they understand. So first of all, they may be versed on some level with like the lore of the knife bearer.
Right.
So that's possible. You know, if they're coming from Lord Asriel and you seem Lord Asriel at this point has some concept of what the knife is and its history. But yeah, also, I think it's just a thing of respect. You know, warrior to warrior, or like an act of good faith too.
I also wonder, like they communicate with this lodestone resonator. They can communicate across worlds. There's got to be an energy there that they recognize.
Yeah,
it's something about, you know. I sort of feel like when creatures are that small, they're sort of in touch with energy. Uh-huh. You know, there must be something around that knife. It's probably swimming in dust.
Yeah,
and
I bet.
It's also so dangerous. One little touch to them and they could bleed out, you know?
100%.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, like they're creatures of their word and they just came to a ceasefire agreement.
Right.
And they're going to abide by it.
They're not the bearer. I think they sort of understand. You're not the bearer. Hmm. It's not for you. It's nothing you can do with it.
Also, it's as big as they are.
That's true.
So
it's very large.
To them, it's like handling like a 6-foot-tall chainsaw. Another Dust Bunny, Amma mentions this as she's going to the cave before she's met, or I think right when she meets Will and Yorick. She has this aside where she says she had never seen soldiers, but people did talk about strange and frightening men, or they might be ghosts seen on the mountainsides at night. But there had always been ghosts in the mountains. Everyone knew that. So they might not have anything to do with the woman. So I think that those two sentences, the sentences explaining it, are Amma's way of explaining away something that probably is not ghosts, that there is something happening here. I don't have any immediate idea of what this is, but I just feel like Philip Pullman would put this in for flavor that like, there is some activity, but who I'm just really interested if you had any guesses, who are these strange and frightening men?
There had always been ghosts in the mountains. Everyone knew that. I wonder if it's specters.
Could be specters.
Like that adults are seeing.
Yeah. Or it could be the men of Shitagase.
Right.
You know, over the years that they'd cut holes
right.
and
people appeared. Coming through.
Yeah. Or like soldiers or agents from, say, Will's world, mm-hmm. you know, like government agents who had come through and like experimenting.
Because yeah. it looks like these are people they're seeing recently and she's connecting it to. But there's always ghosts in the mountains. Everyone knows that.
Right.
So it's like an old folktale that she's explaining the recent activity of people coming through cuts and people swarming looking for Lyra and looking for Mrs. Coulter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or even more generally exploring this mm-hmm. interdimensional
totally.
Situation from God knows what worlds.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just thought this was interesting. This like... I really love lines like this that just suggest like that there's more activity, that we're just seeing one of the stories that's kind of unfolding as, you know, the worlds are ripped asunder. Thought it was a cool passage.
Cool.
Is it time for the alethiometer?
It is time for the alethiometer.
All right, folks.
I'm going to do mine?
Yeah.
So I chose the Madonna for all the motherhood themes. I mean, my God. Between
yeah.
Will,
oh, yeah.
Elaine, Mrs. Coulter, it's the reason the knife breaks, the seeing... You know, the idea of care and is Mrs. Coulter telling the truth? There's just mother stuff all over this chapters. I chose the helmet because of all this is the first time we're seeing the might of war
yeah.
in these chapters. And
yeah.
we're seeing all these people converge on a point and what could have happened and the fights maybe that lay ahead. And you're starting to see the impressivity of Miss Lord Asriel's forces, of the church,
mm-hmm.
two sections of the church working together in a warlike way. And I chose the serpent not because of evil, but because of guile, because of the vagueness of Mrs. Coulter's actions, because of the sort of little deception that Will has to pull on the Chevalier and Lady Salmakia. Like, there's a lot of beguiling going on.
Yeah.
Here.
Yeah.
So those are my three.
Awesome. So my first one is the sun.
Mm-hmm.
Like the sun, they're in the center of everything. There's like two different armies fighting, and there's Amma saving Lyra, and there's Lyra, and there's Will, and Yorick is out there, and the Galavespians are inside, and Asriel is like, his presence is sort of felt, and it's like they're in the center of the sun, you know? It's like this, it's all happening. It's all combusting around them. My second one is the Alpha and Omega. And I chose this one. This one does not get chosen very often because you have Will and you have Mrs. Coulter and you have Lyra and you have Yorick. And I just feel like these four are the big players. And so you have, you know, Alpha and Omega comes from the Bible. You know, I am the Alpha and Omega
yeah.
and the whole world. It's like these are the big players, and they're Will and Mrs. Coulter face to face.
Yeah.
You know, the two maybe most dangerous people in a holistic sense in these books. Maybe you want to throw Yorick in there too, and he is there. But it's just really cool to see that clash. My third one is the crocodile. And this is just for the Swiss Guard soldiers.
Mm.
Just these like armored, dangerous critters. I love that they have these crossbows, these like rapid fire crossbows
yeah.
that are accurate to 300 yards, deadly, and totally silent.
Accurate to 300 yards. That's three football fields.
Yeah.
That's insanity.
That's insanity. That's like a
like
most
a bullet.
Rifles.
Yeah,
days.
I was going to
yeah,
say.
Like modern rifles.
That's crazy.
That might even be more than modern rifle.
I love that these funny outfit wearing Swiss Guard are like the most dangerous.
Right. I did picture. Do you picture them in the
I
woods
do.
With their poofy?
I do. I do. With the lace ruffles and the poofy pants.
Deus revolt.
All right. Let's do our extra award.
Extra award.
I'm giving it to Amma.
Yeah.
Come on. She's great. She's like, I don't know. I'm not being cut out of this adventure. I'm going to save her. And then she just disappears. Just like, y'all got a war. Peace. I'm out.
I'm out. I'm
I love Amma.
Yeah, I love it. Sometimes the extra award is good. I'm going to give it to you, the Galavespians.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they're so wildly brave, and they don't give a shit that they are like 10 inches tall.
Yeah.
Yeah. They are dangerous.
They're like, we will wreck you.
Yeah. If you insult them, they're like, oh yeah, well, how about I kill your best friends? How about I stab him in the neck with my poison spur?
Also, you must be respectful to me while I threaten you. And
yeah.
Will's just like, nah.
The way they're like lecturing Lyra, like, you are a spoiled, insolent child. She's like, have you any idea what I've been through?
She actually says, I agree.
Yeah. She's like, no,
which
I
is
am.
So
that's true.
Weird.
Like, that's true. Like, I'm a lot
fair,
more than that, but I am that.
You know what? Fair play.
Yeah. Yeah, I just love them. Gala best fans forever. Four Evs.
Hey, the mixtape will be back.
It will.
I think you'd rather have the podcast than the mixtape right
think
so. Now. We're getting there. But that's all for this week, y'all.
Yeah, we are so excited to be back into this. We are doing, I think, 14 and 15 next week.
Yep.
We will let you all know.
Yeah, if you're curious whether it's going to be two or three chapters, we'll try and say so on social. It'll be always at least two. But if it feels like the pieces, like it did with this one, feels like the pieces would be weird to break, we'll do a third or maybe even a fourth if it's the right kind of story reason.
Right. And we'll try and let people know ahead of time sort of what to expect in case you're reading along. And hey, if you liked this podcast, check out mischiefmedia.com. There's a bunch of other podcasts that are like it about all kinds of stuff. We don't have to get into all of it. You guys have probably heard this spiel before, but they are sincerely awesome. They have the same spirit as this podcast. Patreon.com/makingmischief.
Making mischief.
If you want even more content, it is awesome content. There's like extra episodes, there's artwork, there's playlists, there's access to our special Discord that you can only get into if you are a Patreon member. So come hang out with us like in real time.
Yeah.
So check out that stuff. Stay tuned for next week and
stay extra.
Stay extra.